this morning we will continue to hear about this fascinating pastime with many contradictory elements. Yesterday we heard about Indra. We heard about how powerful he is. We also heard about how he has mixed motives, how he wants to maintain his position of power and strength at all costs, and how he disrespected Brihaspati. So please remember all of that as we continue on with this pastime. So then, after the second guru of Indra, Vishwarup, was killed by Indra, he was in difficulty, as we heard, and he approached at that time Lord Narayan, because Tvastra, who was the father of Vishwarup, created from his own austerity, the Prabhupada says, Vritrasura was the essence of the austerities undergone by Tvastra, and yet the thunderbolt killed him. Indeed, not only he, but also many other stalwart heroes, whose very skin could not be injured even by all kinds of weapons, were killed by that same thunderbolt. So Indra, when Vritrasura was created from Tvastra's anger and austerity, he was given the advice to go to Dadichi and beg Dadichi for his bones, for his body, because he had had this Narayan Kavacha. He had been chanting this Narayan Kavacha for a long time, which was a mantra given to Indra himself by Vishwarup, which had come from Dadichi. He'd been chanting for a long time, so if you could get his bones and you could grind them and fashion them into a thunderbolt, it would be extremely powerful, and in fact it would be invincible, and practically speaking you could kill your enemy Vritrasura by this thunderbolt weapon. So Indra did that, and then the battle began. Vritrasura was already approaching when Indra went to see Lord Narayan and pray to Lord Narayan for his protection and his blessings and his guidance. Vritrasura was already there, and all the demigods had come out to face all the asuras, or the demons. The two parties had established themselves in an area for battle, and when they were about to start the battle and the demigods all raised their weapons, Vritrasura, by his power, he reduced all the weapons to nothing. He took all their weapons. So they became quite frightened. But now the demigods have got, Indra has his powerful Narayan weapon, and they're about to begin fighting again. And when the asuras, or the side of Vritrasura, when they see the demigods have come again, and this time they're very, very powerful, they become very worried. When all the asuras came onto the battlefield, headed by Vritrasura, they saw King Indra now carrying the thunderbolt and surrounded by all of his soldiers. And his effulgence was so bright that it was intolerable to the demons. So the battle begins with all of the demons on the other side running away. They took one look at what they're about to face. They saw the power of the other party, and they turned on their heels and they ran. So Vritrasura was quite disgusted, and his own men all deserted. But then he saw something else that he found quite dishonorable, and that was that the demigods thought this is our opportunity, and they ran after the demons and were killing them from behind. So neither of these things were up to the Kshatriya etiquette. First, you don't run from a fight, and second, you don't kill an enemy from the back, because it means he's retreated. He's not worthy to be killed. So this was taking place, and Vritrasura was watching this, and he was so disgusted that he started to chastise both parties. First, he chastised his own men, and then he chastised the demigods for taking part in such an unmanly, unfair competition. Then, in this very angry mood, Vritrasura started to remember what Indra had done, how he had killed Vishvarup mercilessly. As he said, "You killed him just like a butcher kills an animal. You slaughtered him, and he was a Brahmin, and he was your guru, and you killed him like that." And Vritrasura became almost blind with emotion and anger towards Indra. And he started telling Indra very harsh words what he thought of him and how he was prepared to kill him. And Indra became quite worried. Then Indra took his club, powerful club that he carries, and he whirled it in the air and sent it flying towards Vritrasura. And Vritrasura caught it with his left hand. And he took the club in his left hand, and within 1 second he threw it back, and it hit Airavata, the elephant carrier of Indra, and knocked him back 14 meters. And Indra fell off. And now everyone was very worried, because this was not a very good sign. So then Indra is standing there feeling very frightened. And Vritrasura starts to speak to him. Now let me just get my place. When he was talking to Indra before he did that, he was saying to him, "You are naturally cruel. And if the other demigods, unaware of my prowess, follow you by attacking me with raised weapons, I will sever their heads with my sharp trident. And with those heads I shall perform a sacrifice to Lord Shiva, the head of the ghosts, along with his hordes. But if in this battle you cut off my head with your thunderbolt and kill my soldiers, O Indra, I shall take great pleasure in offering my body to all other living entities, and I shall thus be relieved of my obligation to the reactions of my karma, and my fortune will be to receive the dust from the lotus feet of great devotees like Narada Muni." Now Indra becomes a little bit worried when he hears this, because this is not usually what you say on a battle, that you're going to receive the dust of great devotees. You usually curse the other party, that's understandable, but then you talk about how you're going to become supreme and you're going to actually win and you'll take over the kingdom of heaven and you'll destroy everything that's in your way. But he's speaking quite differently. He says to Indra, he says, "O king of the demigods, since I, your enemy, am standing before you, why don't you hurl your thunderbolt at me? Although your attack upon me with your club," which he had just done, "was certainly useless, like a request for money from a miser, the thunderbolt you carry will not be useless. Have no doubt about this. The thunderbolt you carry to kill me has been empowered by the prowess of Lord Narayan and the strength of Dadichi's austerities." Now, how did he know this? Because Vishwarup fashioned the thunderbolt for him, for Indra. And it is said in the Vedas that Tvastra and Vishwarup are the same. Tvastra is a name for Vishwarup. So his own father fashioned the thunderbolt at the request of Lord Vishnu for this battle. So this is extraordinary. This is not like anything you watch on television or in a movie or something like that, where everybody has base selfish intentions. The whole culture, our whole Western, not Western, our whole modern Kali Yuga culture, Western, Indian, everywhere, is all based on selfishness. In fact, the material world is based on selfishness, but particularly nowadays, because there is like so much cloud in the way of transcendental ideals, that everyone is quite happy to be thoroughly selfish and think themselves successful. The more selfish they can become, the more they can amass for themselves, the greater the gain they have achieved in their life. So here is a battle that's taking place where both parties are playing their roles. They're not based on this selfish greed. So this is a little extraordinary. And as I said, most people will say, Oh, this is some kind of mythology, just some sort of made-up story, because nobody's like this. Everybody is like what we see today, and it must have always been that way. But Srila Prabhupada said even practically 100 years ago, there were people who had this strength of character. Not, of course, on this level, because this is a pastime, but the strength of character was still there. But as Kali Yuga progresses and things become more and more darkened, we'll see people will think, at some point people will think, I don't ever believe that anyone could live past 40 years old. It's impossible. You tell me that people live to be 60, 70, 80? Impossible. Because they will not have the lifespan anymore. And so they will disbelieve that once upon a time people had greater abilities and greater good fortune than they. So we should think, if ahead they will disbelieve what we're doing, we should remember we should not disbelieve what has come before us that we have no information or knowledge or experience of. Because otherwise we will remain just simply getting more and more contracted in our view of reality until we get a very small, like a keyhole. If you look through a keyhole and you say, I want to see what the whole world is like, and you look through a little keyhole, you just only see the size of the key. So we should not be like that. We should expand our consciousness by our spiritual practice. So he knows that this is empowered to kill him. So he tells King Indra that you should not be afraid. You should use your thunderbolt and you will be victorious. By the force of your thunderbolt, I shall be free of material bondage and give up my body and this world of material desires. That's what he wanted, to give up my body and this world of material desires. Fixing my mind on the lotus feet of Lord Shankarshan, I shall attain the destination of great sages like Narada, just as Lord Shankarshan has said. So we will find out what he means when he says that Lord Shankarshan has told him this. We will find that out this afternoon. But he is very confident. He knows where he's going. And he's telling Indra, don't worry, you will get whatever you want. And I will get whatever I want. Now, here, this is in the chapter 11 of this sixth canto pastime, begins the four prayers of Vritrasura. There are four verses which are the prayers that he spoke. And our acharyas have said that so far in the Srimad Bhagavatam, because the Bhagavatam is meant to take somebody higher and higher and higher in their conceptions of bhakti until they come to the point where they can enter into an understanding of Krishna's pastimes. So previous levels are lower, right? If you're going up steps, you get lower and higher. But because all those steps are going up to this point, they're all considered pure devotional service. They're all the levels up. But until this point, none of the personalities have expressed the mood of bhakti that Vritrasura has. So he opens up a new step, a new threshold by his bhakti emotion feelings, by his level of advancement. And yet, he's a demon. He's an asura. He's fighting with the demigods who are known to be devotees. So this is very mysterious. So he says, before he offers his prayers, he says, persons who fully surrender at the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and always think of his lotus feet are accepted and recognized by the Lord as his own personal assistants or servants. The Lord never bestows upon such servants the brilliant opulences of the upper, lower, and middle planetary systems of this material world. Now that's enough to make some people unhappy, isn't it? He never bestows these opulences upon who? Just like when we're starting to get a bit worried, my gosh, I'm going to be poor my whole life. Who doesn't he bestow these opulences on? Those who always think of his lotus feet. and are accepted and recognized by him as his servants. To them he doesn't give this. Now just think, if your father was a very, very, very wealthy man, one of the wealthiest men in the world, and he's going to give you a birthday present, does he go to the local Kmart or the Woolworths or Big W and buy you some trinkets of gold embossed jewelry, some cheap with little plastic gems in it? Does he buy you something like that, something artificial? Or does he buy you, because he's so wealthy, he buys you something exquisite? Don't you expect that? He will buy something priceless because he's so wealthy. But if you want this other one, and you're saying, but I saw this in the shop, it was so nice, please, 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 I want it. It's just, it's very fashionable, everybody has one. I want that, please, I want that. He might send one of his servants out to go and get that because, you know, you have some desire for it. But what does he want to give you? He wants to give you something much more valuable than that. And factually speaking, he's just giving you that because you have a bit of a childish desire for it. All right, you can have that also. So this is the way that Krishna is thinking towards his servants. He wants to give us something priceless. He wants to give us something, you could say, untarnishable, something imperishable, something that has no downside. We're so used to having happiness and distress like this, back to back. So I want the happiness, but when I take the happiness, I have to take the distress as well. You must, because they're galvanized together. You cannot have one without the other in this world. And we're used to this combination, and we think somehow or other it's okay. In fact, we think it's good. And some people say, well, if I didn't have distress, I wouldn't appreciate the happiness. And we've created so many theories and logic and philosophies all based around this, because we have no choice than to take these two together. And he's saying, I want to take that away and give you an abundance of happiness that has no negativity to it. And we might say that sounds boring. And he might say, no, no, you don't understand. It has all kinds of varieties within it. It's not static. It's ecstatic. It's not just one boring thing. Like when we were growing up, we were told that if you're very good, you'll go to heaven. But we didn't know about Indra. We only knew that heaven was up there somewhere, and there were angels up there, and everything up there was good, and everything that was bad was down there, and all our friends were going down there because they were interested in those things, and I was going to end up there. And what was it going to be like up there? It was going to be like one Sunday after another Sunday after another Sunday, endlessly, you know. And I would think, oh, it sounds really boring up there. And so, of course, all our friends were going down there, so we also thought, let's go and have a look what is down there. And one very clever Indian American writer, he said, heaven for climate and hell for company. This is it. All our friends are going that way. So this is what we have. We have such a pale, such a bland idea of what Krishna is like, such a bland idea of what Krishna Loka is like. And so we have very, very little aspiration to get there. And we have such a vivid experience of life in this world, and we're active there. Watch how much of our energy is going there. Our brain is going here, there, 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 here, here, here. Everything is going on here, and nothing is going up here. And so therefore, when we're told you go here, we're no, 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 I want to go here. But Vritrasura, everything was going on up there. And so he's standing to face Indra. Knows that Indra is going to kill him. Prepared to try and kill Indra because he's a warrior and he has ethics. He has ideal character because he's a devotee. Prepared to try and kill Indra, knows that Indra is going to kill him and wants Indra to do it as quickly as possible. So Indra is a little flabbergasted by all of this. This is not what he expected at all. He expected a good battle and he expected that he would win outright. So then again, Vritrasura speaking before he offers his prayers, he says, "Our Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, forbids his devotees to endeavor uselessly for religion, economic development, and sense gratification." He's saying this to Indra, who's the personification of these things. "O Indra, one can thus infer how kind the Lord is. Such mercy is obtainable only by unalloyed devotees and not by persons who aspire for material gains." So this is the reason also why Srila Prabhupada has had such an immense effect on all of our lives. And we should know this, that whomsoever comes to us representing Srila Prabhupada, who has been also affected by Srila Prabhupada, is giving you the opportunity to come in touch with his purity. And when we ourselves go out to give something to others, we also are giving Srila Prabhupada's purity in the form of his books, in the form of his teachings, in the form of his example. Because, as it says here, such mercy is unobtainable, is obtainable only by unalloyed devotee. Vritrasura requested Indra to release his thunderbolt against him as soon as possible, so that both he and Indra would benefit according to their proportionate advancement in devotional service. Then Vritrasura says, now he offers his prayers. "O my Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, will I again be able to be a servant of your eternal servants who find shelter only at your lotus feet? O Lord of my life, may I again become their servant so that my mind may always think of your transcendental attributes and my words always glorify your attributes and my body always engage in the loving service of your lordship." This is what Vritrasura wants. "O my Lord, source of all opportunities." Source of all opportunities. That's a very powerful statement. That he is the source of all opportunities means we can get whatever we want. He says, "I do not desire to enjoy in Dhruva Loka or the heavenly planets or the planet where Lord Brahma resides, and nor do I want to be the supervisor or the supreme ruler of all the earthly planets or the lower planetary systems. I do not desire to be master of the powers of mystic yoga, and nor do I want liberation if I have to give up your lotus feet. O lotus-eyed Lord, as baby birds that have not yet developed their wings, baby birds not yet developed their wings, always look for their mother to return and feed them. Or as baby calves, little calves, small delicate little calves, tied with ropes, eagerly await the time for milking, when they will be allowed to drink the milk of their mothers. Or as a morose wife whose husband is away from home, always longs for him to return and satisfy her in all respects. I always yearn for the opportunity to render direct service to you." So now Vritrasura is expressing his heart. Just think, have you ever seen a baby bird? They just open their mouth and they just cry until the mother comes, because they're totally dependent on the mother to bring their food. They can go nowhere. If the mother is somehow or other killed, the baby birds also will have to die. And if you have ever been fortunate enough to watch a calf and a cow, especially in India, where you have the calf and the calf comes running. I remember we lived for some time in the Goshala in Vrindavan. And we had a room in the middle, and on one side were the cows that were milked, and on the other side was one area where they kept the calves. And what they would do is they would plan to milk this particular cow, and the man on the other side, they'd make some calling sound, and he would release that particular calf, the calf of that cow. And this little calf would come running out of this kind of enclosure, and they were so cute, and they'd run out, and they couldn't kind of get steady on their legs because they were so small. And they'd run around there so fast and around the back, around past the room to the front. And there they were right in front of the mother. And they're like looking because now they can have some milk. And the mother's looking at them. And then they go underneath and they start sucking. And they always take their heads and they go boom, like this, in the udder of the mother to get the milk going. And the mother moves her leg a little bit and the milk starts pouring out. And then they take the little calf and they bring the calf around the front. And they tie the calf just in front of the mother. So the mother just looks at the calf and all of her milk comes. She lets down all her milk. And then they milk the cow and milk the cow and milk the cow. And then there's a little bit left, just enough. Because the mother gives much more than the calf can digest. Once that's her love. She gives so much more. And that's for us. So then they let the calf free again. And the calf is so eager to get that milk. So he's saying, I'm eager like that. These are the analogies that he chooses to describe how eager he is, how much he's yearning for direct devotional service to the Lord. Then he says, O my Lord, my Master, I am wandering throughout this material world. As a result of my fruitive activities, I'm wandering here and there because I wanted this and I got this and now I have this and this is this and so on and so forth. Simply, I therefore seek friendship in the association of your pious and enlightened devotees. My attachment to my body, my wife, my children, and my home is continuing by the spell of your external energy. But I wish to be attached to them no longer. Let my mind, my consciousness, and everything I have be attached only to you. So this is what Vritrasura wants. And when Indra hears this, you can just imagine how he feels. He's just incurred great sinful reactions and difficulty by killing his guru. And now he's standing here in front of this person who he's planned to kill. He's obliged to kill. The demigods have told him to find out how to kill this person. He's standing there. Although Vritrasura repeatedly encouraged Indra to kill him with the thunderbolt, Indra was now morose at having to kill such a great devotee, and he was hesitant to throw it. Vritrasura was very disappointed that Indra was reluctant despite his encouragement. Just see how the mood has changed. So what did Vritrasura do? He realized that now Indra won't kill him. So he starts to make Indra angry. He very forcefully throws his trident at Indra. Vritrasura was not at all interested in victory. He was interested in being killed so that he could immediately return home back to Godhead. That was Vritrasura's interest. So then as he started fighting, he threw his thunderbolt at Indra and said, I will kill you now. So then Indra came back to his senses and they started to fight again. And as they were fighting, they were doing this, fighting backwards and forwards, and Indra took his thunderbolt weapon and he cut off the arm of Vritrasura that was throwing his weapon. And then Vritrasura, even though one arm was completely severed, He approached King Indra and he struck him on the jaw with his iron mace. And he also struck his elephant with his other arm, because he had one arm still available. He struck his elephant as well, and Indra dropped his thunderbolt. And everyone who was watching this battle, just like, you know, at a wrestling match, all the demigods up in the sky became really worried. Oh my gosh, Indra's defeated. Practically speaking, Indra was defeated because he dropped the thunderbolt. So all of the demigods who were watching, they observed that now Indra was in great danger. Having dropped the thunderbolt from his hand in the presence of his enemy, Indra was practically defeated and was very much ashamed. He dared not pick it up. Vritrasura, however, encouraged him. He said, "Take your thunderbolt and kill your enemy. This is not the time to lament your fate." Vritrasura said, "No one is guaranteed of being always victorious except the original enjoyer, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Being dependent and being obliged to accept material bodies, belligerent subordinates are sometimes victorious and sometimes defeated. So keep fighting." So, Vritrasura says, "Don't be morose because of my victory. There is no need to stop fighting. Instead, you should go on with your duty. When Krishna desires, you will certainly be victorious." So this is something for us also. Don't be morose. This was an answer to that. Don't be morose when you lose a battle with yourself. From now on, I'm going to get up early. I'm not going to do this anymore. Don't be morose when you lose the battle, but go on with your duty. So this was the instruction that Vritrasura was giving to King Indra. All living beings in all the planets of this universe, that's everyone, right? All of us, including the deities of all the planets, like Indra, are fully under the control of the Lord. They work like birds who are caught in a net, who cannot move independently. Now here is another point that struck me when I was reading this. Do we feel as if I'm completely controlled at every moment? Do you feel like that? Not every moment, that's right. I'm controlled sometimes, but not every moment. And, you know, other people seem not to be controlled at every moment. Certainly there must be somebody up there who's controlling the weather and so on and so forth. But I have lots of options and I take one, maybe I make a mistake, and then I try and do this, and then I do this, and then I do that. And my children do this, and they do this, and everybody does whatever they feel like. Do you think like that sometimes? I have to admit that I look at the world like that, and I think that sometimes people do things they shouldn't do. It's not good that they do that. They should be doing this. And so therefore I'm looking at the world always as if there is no one in control. As if there's no one in control. And this is the very definition of a demon. This is the very definition. There's no one in control. I have all the choices in the world and I do whatever I want. And more and more and more, this is becoming the motto of modern society. When I was young, there was a famous song that we used to sing and sing and sing. And one of the lines of it was, "It's my life and I'll do what I want." That was what we were thinking. It's my life and I'll do what I want. So when this culture is what we see, this is Kali Yuga's progress. There's no authority. You can't trust authorities because authorities are also prone to do whatever they want. So I should take care of myself. When we're thinking like this, we're out of connection with Krishna. We're out of synchronicity with Krishna's desire for us. And therefore, no matter what we get by this methodology, which is what we're all using, we're never completely satisfied. Have you noticed? Nobody's completely satisfied. If they were completely satisfied, they wouldn't need to do anything more. If I'm completely satisfied, I don't need to eat again because I'm now completely satisfied. But because I'm not completely satisfied, I need more, I need more, I need more. And as I get more, I still don't become completely satisfied. I just keep accumulating. So this is the mentality of an asura. And the mentality of a deva is that I am simply the subordinate servant of the Supreme Lord, and he can do what he likes with me, just as Arjuna was thinking. So here is Vritrasura. He is preaching like this. He's telling Indra, you have no independence. You are going to win this battle. You are going to get what you want. You think you're going to do it by your powers. No, you're going to get it. It's coming anyway. And I have heard Srila Prabhupada say something that goes so much against the grain of the, especially the Indian culture, and that is that even if you don't do anything, you don't get your degrees, you don't go to university and study, whatever is coming to you will come anyway. It'll come. If you're meant to get a certain amount of money, you will get it. And that's so much against the grain. Everyone is thinking, I must get my children a good education because otherwise they'll be poor when they grow up and everything will fall apart. So I must do this and this and this. It's all resting on me to get everything in place for all the coming generations. And Prabhupada gives an example which sometimes I stop and I try to think about. He says that, do you ask for distress? Does anyone seek difficult, painful situations? Do you ask for them? Have you made plans for them? Have you been thinking, now how can I get a difficult, stressful situation? Nobody is thinking in that way, and yet that comes. So he says, similarly, if you reverse and see the other way, the happiness will also come that is due to you, and you cannot change it. And modern society is all about this idea that I can change it. It all rests on me. I can make myself more and more and more happy. I'm not in the control of my destiny. I'm in the hands of my intelligence and my power. And then, with that mentality, we approach Krishna consciousness and we stay in the Indra category. We remain with Indra in the mixed category of something for Krishna and mostly for me. And Krishna should help me get what I need for me. That's why he's there after all. Everything should be coming towards, it's channeling towards me. So who's in the center? I'm in the center and I look at the world on all 360 degrees. I look around and I try to see what will be good for me. And if it's good for me, I'll take it and use it. And if it's not, I don't need that. I don't need that. And I'm always searching around to see what's good for me. The Vritrasura had the opposite mentality. He continues. He tells Indra that everybody is controlled in this way. Oh, my enemy, he says, just look at me. I have already been defeated, for my weapon and my arm have been cut to pieces by you. You have already overwhelmed me, but nonetheless, with a desire to kill you, I am trying my best to fight. I am not at all morose, even under such adverse conditions, and therefore give up your moroseness and continue fighting. The battle continued. By this time, Indra is beginning to understand who he's fighting with. Indra says, I see by your discrimination and endurance in devotional service that despite your dangerous position, you are a perfect devotee of the Supreme Lord, the friend of everyone. You have surmounted the illusory energy of Lord Vishnu, and because of this liberation, you have given up this demonic mentality and have attained the position of an exalted devotee. Demons are generally conducted by the mode of passion. And therefore, what a wonder it is that although you are a demon, you have adopted the mentality of a devotee and have fixed your mind on the Supreme Lord, who is always situated in pure goodness. Sukadeva Goswami then said, Vritrasura and King Indra spoke about devotional service even on a battlefield. And then, as a matter of duty, they began again to fight. Now, Indra had totally changed his attitude. He understood it as my responsibility to do this, and he was prepared to fight. And fight powerfully too, fight to the death, because Vritrasura wasn't going to let Indra off. It was either one of them had to die. So it wasn't that they now shook hands and left the battlefield to have a drink together. No, they were still there, one to kill the other. But now they were doing it in a different state of mind. Both of them were great fighters, and both of them were equally powerful. So Vritrasura took up his club with his other one hand, and he whirled it around in his left hand, and he aimed it at Indra. And Indra took one of his other thunderbolts and he broke that club to pieces. At the same time, he chopped off Vritrasura's other hand. Now he has no hands, no arms. He was bleeding profusely, but he looked very beautiful. Now, when sometimes the descriptions given in the Bhagavatam, they don't sound beautiful to us because we make a composite. What we could imagine from here, you could see somebody maybe after some horrible accident, they lost their arms. It would be so horrible. How could it be beautiful? But because these are leelas, pastimes, this is taking place actually in the heavenly planet. So there's no ugliness like there is here in this world. Even though the fighting is continuing, it has a different quality. So then Vritrasura, who's so powerful, lost both arms. He places his mouth on the ground and he opens his mouth as wide as he can. He's huge. And then, with his fearful death-like teeth, he approaches Indra as if he's going to swallow him up. And all of the demigods become very afraid. What is happening? What is happening? And then all of a sudden, he swallows Indra, and Indra's gone. Everyone is very worried again, because at each turn, even though he's saying it's guaranteed, you see? At each turn, even though it's guaranteed, it appears not to be guaranteed. So we should learn something about our lives with this. Our success in devotional service is guaranteed if we continue. But at each moment we feel it's not guaranteed. But it is guaranteed. But we don't have the omniscience to see it. And also, we have to do our duty. We can't just say, okay, Krishna, bring it on. Bring on the success. Come on, whatever else you want to give me, give it to me now. No. Because that would not be a success. That would be our defeat. Our success is that we're transformed as from Indra's mentality to Vritrasura's mentality. So, Vritrasura has swallowed Indra. Indra is wearing this Narayan armor and he has his thunderbolt with him. So what he does is he cuts his way out from Vritrasura's abdomen. He cuts his way out and he reemerges. And then, when he has done that, when he has come from the belly of Vritrasura, Vritrasura is now dead. So then he begins the process of cutting off his head to prove that he is dead. And it takes Indra with his powerful weapon 360 days to chop off the head of Vritrasura. A huge amount of time. Then, after he has killed Vritrasura in this way, he is glorified by all of the demigods. And there is one comment here before we hear what happens next to Indra. It says, O Maharaj Parikit, the living spark then came forth from Ritrasura's body and returned back to Godhead. While all the demigods looked on, he entered the transcendental world to become an associate of Lord Shankarshan. So Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, who's one of our famous commentators on the Bhagavatam, who illuminates things for us when he cannot quite understand them fully, he explains that Indra, and not Ritrasura, was killed. When Indra was swallowed, Indra was killed. But Ritrasura, he says, when Ritrasura swallowed Indra and his carrier, the elephant, Ritrasura thought, now I have killed Indra, and therefore there is no more need of fighting. Now let me return back to Godhead. Thus he stopped all his bodily activities and became stunned in a trance. So he left before Ritrasura, the body was cut by Indra. Ritrasura said, I've swallowed Indra. Indra is finished. Now let me go. And in a yogic trance, he left his body. And Indra came out and then chopped off the head. But Ritrasura had already gone. Taking advantage of the silence of Ritrasura's body, Indra pierced the body's abdomen, and because of Ritrasura's trance, Indra was able to come out. Now, Ritrasura was in yoga samadhi, and therefore, King Indra, although he wanted to cut his throat, the demon's neck was so stiff that Indra's thunderbolt took 360 days to cut it to pieces. Actually, it was the body left by Ritrasura that was cut by Indra. Ritrasura himself was not killed. In his original consciousness, he returned back to Godhead to become an eternal associate of Lord Shankarshan. Here the word Alokam means the transcendental world of Vaikuntha, where Shankarshan eternally resides. So that was where he wanted to go. He wanted that, and he got that. Indra. Everybody congratulated him. They were very happy because this threat had been removed. They were very pleased. All the demigods were very happy. Only one person was not happy at all. And who was that? Indra. He was very, very, very unhappy because of what he had done. He understood what he had done. He had killed a great Vaishnava. So all the other demigods went back to their own abodes. And Maharaj Parikit, who was hearing this story, he asked Sukadeva Goswami, what was the reason for Indra's unhappiness? I wish to hear about this. When he killed Ritrasura, all the other demigods were extremely happy. So why was Indra unhappy? Sukadeva replied, when all the sages and demigods were disturbed by the extraordinary power of Ritrasura, they assembled and asked Indra to kill him. Indra, however, being afraid of killing a brahmana, declined. He didn't want to kill him. But then they asked him, so this is interesting. I'm sure anyone intelligent will have a question here. King Indra replied, he said, when I killed Vishvarupa, I received extensive sinful reactions. But I was favored, and therefore I was able to divide these sins amongst others. But if I kill Ritrasura, another Brahmin, how shall I get free from the sinful reactions? And hearing this, the sages replied to Indra. They said, O King Indra, all good fortune unto you. Do not fear. We shall perform an Asafoetida sacrifice to release you from any sin you may accrue by killing the brahmana. So hearing about this, Indra went ahead, because they explained that by an Asafoetida sacrifice, everything can be nullified. And so, encouraged by the words of the sages, Indra killed Vritrasura. And when he was killed, the sinful reaction of killing a Brahmana took shelter of Indra. Following the advice of the demigods, Indra killed Vritrasura, and he suffered because of this sinful killing. Although the other demigods were happy, he could not derive happiness from the killing. Indra's other good qualities, such as tolerance and opulence, could not give him any relief in his grief. Wherever he went, he saw the personification of the sinful reaction for what he had done following him. Now it is explained, why did he have a heavy reaction to the second killing? It was because it was calculated. He calculated to kill Vritrasura, whereas in the first instance he lost his temper, he became angry and he did something spontaneous. So he got a reaction for that, but the second time he calculated it and he got a heavier reaction. Now, does that bring any questions to anyone's mind? Yes. Well, that was what went on internally, you could say. But to the eyes of men, to those who were watching, he killed him. Just like if you cut off somebody's head in this room, if you cut off his head, you can't kill him because he's eternal. But it will appear that you have killed him because you damaged his body irreparably. So he didn't kill Vritrasura, but his example was as if he had killed Vritrasura. So he got a reaction for doing that. Yes. 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 The mentality for which you commit an action does affect the reaction. Because somebody may be doing it out of compulsion and they have very little freedom, they'll still get a reaction because they did it. But if somebody calculates, just somebody calculates to blow up the Melbourne Temple and everybody who's there, you know, they have to go to a lot of effort to get that all planned out, right? So that's a lot more sinfulness in doing that, because so much more absorption has gone into what they're planning to do. So yes, there will be a different reaction for that. Any other question? Yes. Bound to get that result. Yes. But what is there, something we just read that's a little unusual here, Muli? Yeah. The sages told him to do it. The demigods and sages told him to do it and told him, don't worry, we will nullify the reaction with the Asavamedha sacrifice. So I remember when I very first read this part of the Bhagavatam many, many, many years ago, a long time ago, I was thinking, this is very strange, because they told him to do it. They gave him authority to do it, and then he got a reaction. So what about for us? Maybe we do something in our devotional life, and we're told to do it, and we do it, and something goes amiss, and we get some kind of a reaction. And sometimes you feel like, but hang on, you told me to do that. So how come I'm getting a reaction for it? How could does that mean the sages weren't authorized? Does that mean that the sages don't have the power to protect you if you listen to them? So maybe you shouldn't listen to them because they said, yes, do it, and he did it, and he got a reaction. What do you think? I think you're correct, but still, just looking at this little gap, Indra's having a difficult time during this time gap. Yes. Well, doesn't that mean that there's something wrong with the sages? We have to check on the sages all the time? So that seems to be still, for the skeptical mind, the mind of the person who is seeing, as we're saying, who's seeing as the asura that nobody is in control, is thinking, these sages, maybe they made a mistake, or maybe they actually don't have the power, or maybe they shouldn't. He was innocent. He was just told to do it. Yes. So how can we trust these sages who I may have an inappropriate desire, but now this sage is giving me inappropriate advice. So how can I trust these sages? Of course I have some inappropriate desires. I'm a human being. You know, everyone has a few inappropriate desires, but the sages told me to do it. But we just heard that he was doing his duty. Okay. This is a good point. The point raised is that he was doing his duty. We heard that. By the end, he was doing his duty. But that he had some attachment to something at the beginning. And therefore, even though he was doing his duty at the end, he wanted something. Yes. I think in this case he was also a Brahmana and a Vaishnava. So the point, I think we cannot split hairs and say that, well, he was a Vaishnava, not a Brahmana, and therefore he got into difficulty in this way. That can be true, technically a little more serious, you could say, depending on the personality, and he's a very exalted person. But what is the key here? Everyone has said relevant things. What is the key? Following instruction, he followed the instruction and he got a reaction for it. Indra is feeling repentful, then why does he have to suffer? He's feeling repentful already. I'm asking this because this is what our mind does to us. Countless times it will do this to us. It will put us out of sight as the cause of the problem. And it will focus on somebody else and say, well, I was just doing what they told me to do. Or I went into this situation because my parents told me to. Or I happened to be in this situation because my husband was there. This, that, so on and so forth. And therefore, we feel like it's unjustified that we have to suffer something. Yes. Taking responsibility. I think so. Of course, this is in a transcendental lila, so it's very much magnified so that we can see it very clearly and understand what's taking place. But I think so. This is a key to the taking responsibility. If you trace it back, and in our own lives, if we trace back whatever difficult situation we're in, Of course, if it goes before our life into our previous life, it's more difficult to trace it back. But if you trace it back, you'll usually find that there was some motivation for something other than Krishna's service that was driving us. And so then people, as everyone has said in their answers, may try to give us advice, and they're trying to steer us towards what is actually a better way of thinking. But we're quite set on the way we're thinking. We have our desires fixed. And so when they give us advice, still it doesn't mean that automatically we're going to be free from the reaction when we act. Because we're motivated to act by our own selfishness rather than motivated by what Vritrasura was motivated by, to just simply return to his service at the lotus feet of the Lord. So Vritrasura appears very sinless, and Indra appears very motivated. But now, because the class is finished for this morning, this afternoon, we want to hear something about how did Vritrasura get like that? We've heard about Indra. We've just discovered that he had mixed motivations and he wanted to enjoy eternally in heaven. And so therefore, he's acting in a chain of events to get what he wants. He has some devotional sentiments. He's a demigod, but he also wants something here. So he's getting that. But how did Vritrasura come to this extraordinary stage? So this afternoon we'll hear a little more of this pastime, and we'll try to enter into this mystery a little more deeply. All right, so when we see Keshava Prabhu, we know that it's time to have our breakfast. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.